Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Haiti in turmoil days after the shocking assassination of its president. What happens now? I'll ask expert and Haiti native Professor Robert Faton. Then, thousands of Cubans protest as the country faces a grave economic crisis. We get the latest on the ground. Plus,
virtually all COVID-19 hospitalizations and deaths in the United States are now occurring among unvaccinated individuals.
All eyes on surging Delta variant cases in America and around the world. Former U.S. Deputy Surgeon General Boris Lushniak joins me on how to contain the spread. And then, elation as Italy wins the Euros championship on a penalty shootout. Host of soccer podcast Men in Blazers, Roger Bennett, breaks down the victory and the fallout.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Golodriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Anampour, who will be back next week. We begin with Haiti, a country in crisis. Nearly a week after the brutal assassination of President Jovenel Moise, there are more questions than answers about what transpired in the Caribbean nation and what happens next. Police say they have arrested a man who allegedly recruited the assassins. That's in addition to at least 20 other suspects who have been detained, most of them Colombian. U.S. officials arrived in the country on Sunday to assist in the murder investigation. Dozens of desperate Haitians gathered outside the U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince on Friday, fearing for their safety.
I can't close my eyes, not since the day before yesterday. I can't sleep at night. I had to come here to the U.S. Embassy because I'm scared. There are many gunshots and you don't even know where they're coming from. I've abandoned my home. I can't go back. I don't know about my family.
Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and with two competing prime ministers, gang violence, and of course the pandemic, it is plunging further into uncertainty. CNN's Matt Rivers is in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince, and he joins me now. Matt, thank you so much for joining us. What is the latest that we know about this suspect, who is a Haitian national with ties to the United States, who authorities are calling the mastermind behind the assassination?
Yeah, Bianca, it's a really interesting update. You know, for a few days, we really didn't get anything from authorities here in Port-au-Prince. It was on Sunday night, though, that officials held this press conference in large part to talk about this man, this 63-year-old who they say was born in Haiti, named Christian Emmanuel Sano. He basically, according to authorities, came here to Haiti to organize this group of Colombian mercenaries, as they have been called by Haitian authorities, as well as two Haitian Americans that also are a part of this suspected group of people that actually carried out this assassination. Haitian authorities basically saying he not only helped organize this group of assassins or alleged assassins here in Port-au-Prince, he also helped recruit them in the first place by working with a Venezuelan security firm based in South Florida. A very convoluted circle here, but clearly what authorities are saying is that they view him as a central figure in this investigation. Even at some point with this press conference with the police chief here saying that he thinks in some way this man wanted to seize power in Haiti without actually elaborating on what that actually meant. So that's what we know. We know they raided his home a few days ago, found some ammo, targets, things like that. But it's far from over at this point. I think that there is a lot of skepticism, and rightly so, that this person is somehow the mastermind behind all of this, that he is where it starts and ends in terms of getting all of these alleged assassins into this country, carrying out this attack. I spoke to the elections minister here in Haiti just yesterday, and he actually believes that there will be more arrests on the island, that the mastermind is still out there. And so as much as this was a big update, Biana, no question about that, the idea that this investigation is over or close to over, or that we really have any idea of the full scope of what's behind this assassination, I think anybody that would tell you that is probably not telling you the truth.
And it really has turned into an international investigation and crisis. You have Colombian officials who are also investigating now where these mercenaries came from and how they were recruited. But in terms of the U.S. response, we know that U.S. security and justice officials are on the ground there in Haiti. What more are we hearing about the Biden administration's response to this unfolding crisis?
I think so far the Biden administration's response has been relatively limited. I think they're here in an advisory capacity. The Haitian officials, Haitian government, led by the acting prime minister at the moment, certainly wants U.S. assistance. But in terms of actually getting lots of boots on the ground, getting their hands dirty in this investigation, I don't think that we are there quite yet. I think the bigger role that you might see the United States play in both the short and medium term would be in the political instability that is the power vacuum right now here in Haiti. It was just yesterday that a U.S. delegation met with the leaders of two competing factions, two political sides here in Haiti, both sides thinking that they should be the one in charge of the country at the moment, that they should be the ones to lead this country into elections at some point down the road. The U.S. basically saying they had constructive meetings, but what didn't come out of these meetings is some kind of consensus, some kind of plan. When are new elections going to be held for both the president but also the parliament? Because remember, there hasn't been elections for parliament. They are well overdue at this point. So there's a big political crisis here in Haiti that is not over yet. And we know that this is a country that when there are political arguments, that often spills over into the streets. Protests are a very common occurrence here. They can turn violent at times. And so we're getting a little bit of word today that there have been few protests here and there, nothing large scale, but that is what we're going to be watching out for over the coming days and weeks, frankly, as Haiti tries to navigate this post-assassination landscape in which who is going to run the country, who's going to set up these elections remains extremely unclear.
All of the details are still so shocking. The country continues to be a tinderbox as the days go on. Matt River, thank you so much. We appreciate your reporting. Well, joining me now to put all this into context is Robert Fatone. He's an expert on Haitian politics at the University of Virginia and a native to the country. His latest book is The Guise of Exceptionalism, Unmasking the National Narratives of Haiti and the United States. And he joins me now from Charlottesville, Virginia. Robert, thank you so much for joining us. What a timely book. And I do want to get to the relationship between these two countries and the history there. But let's just put everything into context right now, because this is a country that has seen crises before. There have been coups. There has been a constitutional crisis. But we have not seen a presidential assassination since 1915. How did we get here? And were there warning signs?
Well, yes, there were warning signs, because the country has been in a permanent state of crisis, in particular in the last 3 or 4 years. The elections in Haiti have actually exacerbated the problems, because the competing political parties and personalities have actually not accepted the results. So that has generated that kind of political instability and uncertainty. In the case of Jovenel Moïse, what precipitated the crisis before the shocking assassination was the fact that, first, when he was elected, he was really a very dubious president in terms of his legitimacy. Only about 15% of the population bothered to vote, and that implies that the vast majority of Haitians did not recognize themselves in those elections. But then you had a series of crises generated by investigations about corruption. And in the past 3 years, there has been the rise, if you wish, of civil society. And it's a different type of phenomenon, because that civil society is composed really of very young people, professionals, and they had huge protest against Moïse, accusing him of corruption, and they wanted his resignation. And then you had the additional crisis of President Moïse's prolongation of his term for people in the opposition. That was illegal. Whereas the president said, I was elected for 5 years, I assumed the presidency in 2017, and therefore I will not resign and I will be president till February of 2022. So we have a context within which you had a political crisis, then you obviously have a severe economic crisis that exacerbates further the type of volatility that you see in Haiti. So it's a confluence of many factors, immediate factors. There are obviously much deeper historical reasons why we got to the situation in which we find ourselves right now.
And without a settled continuity of power, as we see, we know that officials there are still debating as to what the Constitution says, because it had been amended over the past several years about who actually is in charge in the country. And now we're dealing with three men who are saying that they should be the designated leaders of the country, at least for the interim. And we have an acting prime minister, Claude Joseph, a prime minister designate, Ariel Henry, who was just appointed in that position by Moïse just weeks before his assassination, and the Senate president, Joseph Lambert. We have U.S. officials on the ground meeting with all three of them. How likely is it that there will be some resolution, perhaps unity government, that comes out of this?
That is a very complicated issue. If you look at past history, it's unlikely that you're going to have that compromise. On the other hand, the crisis is so profound that cooler heads may prevail. But the problem is that all of the political actors now in Haiti are operating without a real constitution. It's not only that most actors in Haiti and in the external community have violated the constitution of 1987 and then that of 2012, but we do not have the actors that the constitution stipulates. We don't have a president. We don't have a legitimate prime minister. We have an incumbent prime minister, but then we have a prime minister that had been nominated by Jovenel Moïse, who was himself questioned by the population. And then we don't have a parliament because there has been no election, and there are only about 10 senators, and they are themselves, to some extent, divided. So we are operating without a constitution. The constitutional order is really not in operation. So No, I'm saying that, therefore, it's only some sort of compromise between the different political actors. But that in itself may not resolve the situation, because you have now that civil society which wants to be part of that kind of compromise. So you have a traditional political class whose rulers have been, to put it mildly, a disappointment. And then you have that rising civil society that wants to really change the ways Haiti has been governed. And that means, therefore, that it is difficult to find some sort of compromise. If you look at Haitian politics,
I was just going to say, in terms of going forward, I mean, there's a complicated history, and we can bring your book into this, because there is a complicated history of foreign nations and their involvement interfering with Haiti, in particular the United States. We saw that happen under President Clinton in the 90s. This is something clearly that had not been on President Biden's watch list, but here we are right now. How would you advise the Biden administration to move forward here? And what help, what constructive help can the U.S. offer right now? We know that the acting Prime Minister Joseph is asking for U.S. forces on the ground. That is not something that this administration is likely to want to see in the time ahead. But what can be done?
Well, most Haitians in particular, that new rising civil society, they do not want a foreign intervention. They want a government of national unity, a government that would be transitional, that would more or less appease the different factions, and also establish some sort of political order whereby the gangs who have really manifested themselves in particular over the last year would be eliminated from the political picture. And then you need to organize that government, which is a complicated business. That government itself needs to set the terms of its mandate, and that would operate obviously without a constitution, and set date for future election. Now, if I were to advise the Biden administration, I would tell them that they should not really promise a massive intervention. That would be a disaster. I think also they should not ask, and they've been asking for immediate elections. Elections in the current political climate in Haiti are really, in my mind, something that is very much almost insanity. You have gangs controlling significant portions of Port-au-Prince and other towns in Haiti. You don't have the logistical bureaucracy to set up the organization of free and fair elections. And then you don't have an electoral council that is actually acceptable to all of the political actors. So I think the elections have to be postponed and the government of national unity has to be established. Now, whether the international community is going to do that remains to be seen, because we have, as you said, a record of interventions that have not resolved anything. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to take Einstein's dictum about insanity, and that is that you are doing the same thing over and over again, and you expect different results. You will not get different results. And that insanity is in both in the international community and among Haitian actors, because it's the same syndrome that we saw in 1994, in 2004, in 2006, in 2010, 2012, and we see it again.
It is a vicious cycle, as you say. Let's hope that cooler minds prevail there and there is some sort of unity government that can come out of this, at least temporarily, following this tragic unfolding of events there with the assassination, as you mentioned, that we haven't seen in that country in over a century. Robert Fatin, we, of course, will be continuing to follow and monitor this story. Thank you so much. We appreciate your insight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, we want to stay in the region now and turning to Cuba, because something we haven't seen before is unfolding. Thousands took to the streets this weekend to protest a lack of food and medicine in the country. This comes as Cuba faces a grave economic crisis exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. President Biden has called on the Cuban regime to, quote, hear their people and serve their needs. In a statement, he said, "We stand with the Cuban people and their clarion call for freedom and relief from the tragic grip of the pandemic and from the decades of repression and economic suffering to which they have been subjected." CNN's Patrick Ottman has the latest from Havana.
Calling for liberty, protesters take to the streets in Havana. In front of police, the crowd yells, "Fatherland and life," a new opposition slogan that has gotten people who say it in public arrested in Cuba. But Cuba on Sunday seemed a very different place as thousands of people in cities across the island took to the streets and took the government by surprise. These are the largest mass protests in years, perhaps decades. Usually, any anti-government activity leads to immediate arrest. Protests criticizing the state are simply not allowed here. But on Sunday, though, thousands of people voiced their anger openly, and many people told us they simply had lost their fear. Police surrounded the protesters and arrested some of them. But for the most part, they did not or could not stop the demonstrations. The protests are only the latest sign of the unprecedented crisis facing the communist-run island. Even as Cuba produces its own homegrown vaccines, the number of COVID cases has skyrocketed. On Sunday, health officials announced the highest single-day increase in new cases and deaths. For months, the Cuban economy has spiraled further and further downwards. The island has been hard hit by increased U.S. sanctions under the Trump administration, which have continued under President Biden. The pandemic has cut off tourism and the ability to receive help from relatives abroad for many Cubans. Lines for food now stretch around the block and can last for hours. For many in Cuba, waiting for scarce food and medicines has become their life. Every day, there are people out here for whatever there is. Some days, you don't even know what products they're going to be selling, Rachel says. You have to be out here if you want to have food. The economic misery is already leading to desperation, as Cubans are now taking to the sea on rafts in the greatest numbers since 2017, when then-President Obama ended the wet-foot-dry-foot policy that allowed Cubans reaching the U.S. to stay. Cuba is confronting the worst crisis in decades without a Castro at the helm, as Raul Castro stepped down from his last leadership role in April. On Sunday, Cuba's new leader, Miguel Díaz-Canel, blamed the island's economic troubles on the U.S. and vowed to crack down on the protesters. The order to combat has been given, he said. Revolutionaries need to be in the streets. As Cuba edges closer to the edge, neither side appears they are backing down.
A region in turmoil. Well, coming up after the break, we'll look at the worrying spread of the Delta COVID variant in the United States and around the world. I'll be joined by former U.S. Deputy Surgeon General Boris Lushniak. Welcome back. Well, it's fast becoming the most dominant and dangerous coronavirus variant in the world. Public health officials around the globe are struggling to contain the spread of the more transmissible Delta variant as it becomes the Achilles heel in many nations' plans for a return to normalcy this summer. Recent numbers from Israel and the UK suggest that some existing vaccines may be effective, but not as effective at fighting Delta. And drug makers are already beginning plans for booster jabs later this year. But not everyone is convinced that that will be needed.
There's a lot of work going on to examine this in real time to see if we might need a boost. But right now, given the data that the CDC and the FDA has, they don't feel that we need to tell people right now you need to be boosted.
With me now to discuss is former U.S. Deputy Surgeon General Dr. Boris Lushniak. Thank you so much for joining us. A lot of confusion in the country and in the world right now. We seem to have competing narratives from both Pfizer and U.S. health officials, at least in the interim. Pfizer officials and representatives are meeting with U.S. government officials now about their statement that they are expecting the need for more booster shots as now immunity is starting to wane through their research that they've been conducting and following. U.S. government officials, and as we heard, Dr. Fauci saying, hold on, maybe not yet. What is your take on this? Do we need boosters now?
Well, I'm a believer in what Dr. Fauci stated already, in that it's all got to be data-driven right now. So some of the companies, Pfizer in particular, is coming out with some information that needs to be looked at, needs to be further analyzed. But right now, there is no evidence. There's no evidence that boosters are necessary at this point in time. The real question is going to be in the future. And again, don't forget this virus, right? The SARS-CoV-2 virus has been always perplexing. For the last year and a half, every time we think we have it figured out, something new comes up. And unfortunately, I think we're in the pathway right now of having to what? To learn new things about the Delta variant and our reaction. Booster or no booster, right? What is the pathway ahead? That's really a question that still needs to be answered based on.
But to counter that, you know, Pfizer will say they're looking at data, too, and they're looking at two countries, the UK and Israel, and their citizens have been vaccinated in many cases months before the U.S. citizens were getting their vaccine shots. So could Pfizer be seeing something that we are going to see imminently? And why not then counter that with a booster?
Certainly, the Pfizer data is important. They have sort of this international realm, which, by the way, the World Health Organization does as well, as does CDC and FDA. We're not in an island situation here where we're just looking at our own data. However, you know, with the provisions of this emergency use authorization, which basically tells us, based upon the data, how we use the vaccine, several things. Two doses, right, of the two-dose vaccines have given us the immunity necessary. The one dose of the one dose vaccine has given us the immunity necessary. The real sort of unknown right now is what's going on with Delta. Right now, the preliminary information, at least here in the United States, is we seem to be covered. The two doses need to be taken of the two dose vaccines, right? Even the French study last week in Nature talked about the idea that partially immunized individuals won't be fully protected. But you're absolutely correct. We have to be able to monitor this information. I think this meeting with Pfizer that's coming up and U.S. government officials is critical because the idea is let's share the information. Let's come up with the right policies to ultimately protect the world from this.
So much of this is about messaging and trust, right? And we have seen a crushing example of what a lack of trust and a lack in leadership can lead to with the millions of deaths we've now seen throughout the world. Many of them were preventable. And yet here we find ourselves in a position where, you know, one wonders why Pfizer officials had not communicated with public health officials from the CDC and the FDA prior, so there could be sort of a unified message that comes out of this, as opposed to two joint messages where once again there's more confusion. And again, some people are even skeptical that there be maybe some sort of financial incentive. There would be no reason for Pfizer to do that at this point. And we're not saying that they can't be trusted. But I think some of this could have been prevented. And I'm wondering what your take is a year and a half in, why we can't seem to get the messaging right.
You know, this is another OMG moment, isn't it, Deanna? Is that if nothing else, we've learned in this last year and a half how messed up health communication can be. And whether it was early on in the process where everything became politicized, at least here in the United States, or right now, which is the whole idea of, you know, the lack of coordination in terms of getting public health messaging out. And I think that does several things, one of which is it leads to this idea of confusion, not only within the United States, but worldwide. But it also it brings up this whole issue of skepticism, right? Who's telling me what and whom do I believe? We have to get better at this from a public health aspect. Health communication, health literacy are critical to us achieving the end game of this. And the end game is going to be a massive, massive continuing campaign of vaccination worldwide.
You know, at CNN, we have seen and grown all too accustomed to the box that we have on the side of the screen that shows the number of deaths and infections that we'd seen throughout this pandemic. And fortunately, over the past few months, we'd started to see that go down. Now there's been an uptick in new cases, and the majority of them are attributed to the Delta variant here right now. And in the United States alone, the majority of cases that we do see of people being hospitalized or sick are those that have not been vaccinated. We are living in a country where there's an embarrassment of riches. Anyone who wants a vaccine can get one. And yet there seems to be one political party in this country that's arguing that the government should not be advocating that people try to stay alive. For lack of a better word, I want to play for you some sound from the CPAC meeting over the weekend.
There is a chance that we wind up with a sort of much more health authoritarian state than we have, where essentially you have to be vaccinated against this if you want to have any semblance of a normal life. They were hoping, the government was hoping, that they could sort of sucker 90% of the population into getting vaccinated, and it isn't happening, right? Younger people are well aware of what the risks are.
I mean, you hear people cheering there in Texas. We're talking about a country, you know, that has a plethora of vaccines available. Other countries would be envious of this. There's a reason we don't talk about polio anymore in this country. That's because of vaccines. We send our children to schools having to show that they have been vaccinated. What is your take on how political this issue has become now?
This is, you know, a continuation of politicization, perhaps even getting worse, right, as time goes on, right? I've been a public health practitioner my whole career. I'm now a dean of a school of public health at the University of Maryland, so I'm teaching the next generation of public health leaders. And in essence, that statement that you just played really is a reflection of how crazy, how insane this has gotten. First of all, the idea that public health is out there somehow infringing on people's rights, and that we're somehow hoodwinking people, trying to persuade them, right, against their will to take this vaccine is not obviously helpful to the ultimate message. The facts are there. You absolutely were right when you stated the idea that we're now seeing a slight uptake, right? But the slight uptake can become a big uptake. 16% increase in the last 7 days of cases in the United States. 9% increase of hospitalization. Compared to what we had in the wintertime, that's, you know, it's heading in the wrong direction. It's not as bad as it once was. But what I hate, you know, is from an epidemiological perspective, is seeing any increase whatsoever. And the answer here is clear. You either get the vaccine or you're going to get COVID. That's the way we should be selling this right now. That's the way we should be persuading individuals. And ultimately, that'll lead to protection, not only within the United States, but also in the world.
Yeah.
Don't forget, on a worldwide basis, right now, only 25% of the world has one dose of vaccine, right, that's been delivered to them. Low-income countries, less than 1% are vaccinated. We have a battle ahead of us. And in this land of riches, we should be doing much better.
Well, thank you so much, Doctor, for coming on and spreading the facts with our viewers. We're very fortunate to have vaccines in this country. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, still to come tonight, the ugly side of the beautiful game. A glowing victory for Italy's national soccer team in the postponed Euro 2020 championship, and a devastating defeat for England's Lions. More on the match and how racism continues to mar soccer. That's coming up next. Welcome back. An euphoric victory and scenes of delight across Italy. As the country's national soccer team beat England in a nail-biting final and claimed the Euro 2020 soccer championship. And a heartbreaking defeat for an English side robbed of the chance to bring it home for the nation again. It's a loss made even harder by a savage outpouring of racist abuse, which has been leveled at the English players by supposed fans. Sports officials, politicians, and fans are speaking out against the players' shocking treatment. And England manager Gareth Southgate had these words in support of his men.
For some of them to be abused is unforgivable, really. I know a lot of that has come from abroad. You know, the people that track those things have been able to explain that, but not all of it. And it's just not what we stand for. We I think, have been a beacon of light in bringing people together, in people being able to relate to the national team. And the national team stands for everybody.
After a tournament of heartwarming and inspiring performances by England's most diverse squad ever, it's a vile reminder of the bigotry which can still emerge in the sport. Joining me now is Roger Bennett, self-proclaimed soccer nut whose humble podcast, Men in Blazers, has gone on to become a broadcasting empire. His new book, Reborn in the USA, is a love letter to his chosen country and debuts on the New York Times bestseller list this week, at the top of the list, I believe. Welcome to the program, Roger. It is wonderful to have you on. I don't see a smile on your face, and I was really hoping to see one. I didn't care who was going to win. I was slightly rooting for England, if only because I knew that I would be talking to you today. I know you were reborn in the USA, but you were born in England, and you have been rooting for that country and that team for so many years. It came so close. How are you feeling today?
You know, Bianca, I can measure my life in England's footballing agony and failure, that cycle of big dreams and shattered dreams. And this team did become agonizingly close. 55 years it's taken since we were last in a final to shattering that. It's almost like a team of Sisyphusian footballers in cleats. They rolled that rock so close to the top of the mountain, only to let it slip at the last through their fingers, over their toes and back down. Huge credit to the fantastic Italians, who fully deserved and had their own narrative of destiny. But this is such a terrific group of young human beings who've really redefined what it means to be a footballer from the early 2000s, when it was all about champagne, VIP rooms, drive a Lambo, crash a Lambo, buy another Lambo. These kids really embraced, with a diverse face, a social justice, LGBTQ rights, anti-racism, child poverty and hunger. They were a modern face, a briefly very happy face of the nation, and one that I actually hope still comes to be true.
And look, you've hit on so many important points there. The second youngest team, I believe, in the tournament. Such a diverse team, right? And they weren't expected to get this far, let's be honest. I mean, I think it's pretty fair to say that the better team won as far as tactics are concerned and playing is concerned. And before we get to the ugly side of what transpired overnight, I do want to talk more about the technical aspect of the game, because Gareth Southgate is receiving some heat about his choice as to who would be performing performing there and playing for those penalty kicks at the end. There were three players who are amazing rising stars. One hadn't played much throughout the game at all. And they're just, let's be honest, not very seasoned. Is the criticism that he's receiving just from a tactical standpoint correct or accurate in your opinion?
Now, tournament football, going this deep, it's an incredible achievement just to reach the final. And you need to have talent. You need to have a remarkable culture within those gents. And you also need luck. And I've watched this team with just delirious joy. They did something almost impossible, which is take the nation, England, which is deeply divided. Football, at the end of the day, just holds up a mirror to the culture that surrounds it. And that mirror does not always show a pretty picture. They fleetingly allowed the English people to feel joy after these months of lockdown and the awful grind of Brexit before it. They allowed them to take off their shirts, to throw their beers into the air, to feel joy and fleetingly feel a sense of unity. So I admire Gareth Southgate. He is a deeply emotionally intelligent leader. I think Barney Renee and The Guardian called him the last sane man left in England. And God love, if he was actually Prime Minister, I think Britain would be like Scandinavia right now. So I'm not going to knock him in any way. And sending kids to take penalties, these are gents who have practiced all of their life. You cannot practice for that crucible of penalties, which is just, it's like a Russian roulette that's barely even connected to the game, the 90, 120 minutes that came before it. Jurgen Klinsmann used to say, you know, sometimes you can pick young kids because they do not know enough to be afraid. They don't know they're meant to be afraid. Unfortunately, we saw yesterday, sometimes that experience, that veteran savvy, not knowing enough doesn't deliver. And my heart breaks for them. Last night was awful to watch. Be honest, it was even worse to wake up this morning to just see the vile abuse that they received, which is searing, unforgivable, and really a reflection of that division within England, which football cannot heal alone.
It is disgusting. It is vile, and it's the ugliest part of social media throughout all of this. And Gareth Southgate, it was very prescient in his letter to England and its fans June 8th, as this tournament was just unfolding, and a warning about what all of this can lead to and the vile comments that his players are on the receiving end of. And, of course, we talk about those three players, Marcus Rashford and his teammates Jadon Sancho and Bukayo Saka. They have been now the target of vicious racial abuse. There was a mural honoring Marcus Rashford, which was vandalized. This is a team that came together in support of anti-racism causes, taking the knee, embracing all. Again, the future of England is what all of these young men represented. I'm curious to get your thoughts on how this impacts all of the work that they've done throughout this tournament to become the darlings.
I can't imagine what they feel like this morning. One of the elders of the team, the veterans, Raheem Sterling, who's been most articulate and just incredibly, a searing leader on the issues of race, football, and British culture. You know, he had an incredible tournament. 5-6 years ago, the tabloid media and an element of the fan base were tearing him down every single move that he makes. He was in this tournament, he was lauded as a hero. Let's build statues of him all over Britain. You know, football fandom is deeply fickle. I feel for these kids. They are 19, they are 20, they are 21. They have huge careers before them. The racial element is, as soon as they missed, I think every sage human being who's watched these cycles of the English media and English fan base, there was a darkness that they'd lost, but there was a darkness and a fear at all that was to come. But I will say Gareth Southgate himself, the manager in 1996, missed a penalty which knocked England out of their most delirious tournament at home, Euro 96. He said it was a wound that will never heal. But from such a wound, lessons about life are learned that has made him a better human being. And you see the goodness that man brings out into the world. I have no doubt these three footballers, please God, will follow in his pathway.
Roger, nothing warmed my heart more than seeing Southgate and Gareth there
hugging all of these players at the end, right, and consoling them. The shootouts are fun, but they're just so heartbreaking for the losing team. Let's bring your book into this, because you take out England and soccer and insert NBA and NFL, and a lot of this can transpire in the United States as well, your beloved home, your adopted home, your chosen home. Congratulations, you've become a U.S. citizen in 2018, and you wrote a book, Reborn in the USA, about your dreams of always becoming an American. You say you were born to be an American. Your great-grandfather just got off a little bit early and in England. But you had put certain aspects of the U.S. on a pedestal. And here we're seeing before our eyes over the last few decades, if not through our history, that we have rose-colored glasses on as well. I'm curious to get your take on how you've absorbed the good and the ugly of this great country.
Bianca, my book is a love letter to the United States from a gentleman who has shaped his life around the American idea and became an American citizen in 2018, just before things here really descended into the chaos. I wrote it during lockdown in New York City, a city that I had painted on the skyline, a very crude image, at a skyline of Manhattan painted on my bedroom wall in Liverpool in the 1980s. I grew up there, a magnificent city, but back then, the north of England under Thatcher was really laid to waste. The economics, politically, culturally, the coal mines shut down, the steel mills ground to a halt, the cotton mills, and Liverpool, this once great port city, was left to rot. Unemployment soared, heroin epidemic gripped the city. You know, if you've seen Billy Elliot, you kind of get the picture of what life looked like. He had ballet dancing. I didn't. And I learned to survive by just imbibing everything American I could lay my hands on. You know, the television Heart to Heart, Fantasy Island, Miami Vice, the Chicago Bears, Run DMC. And of course, my one true queen, Tracy Chapman. All of them taught me life lessons about possibility, hope and courage. And I wrote the book in lockdown that descended into the Black Lives Matter movement and then the chaos of the 2020 election. And I'll just say that if you have stood in a courtroom, as I did in Lower Manhattan, with 162 other freshly minted new Americans, some of whom walked through deserts, survived famine, civil war to be here, to the idea of America that I wrote about, you know, the idea of America, when you talk to them, gave us courage, gave us confidence, gave us a sense of hope when we most needed it. And ultimately, that's the narrative that I try and engage with in the book. The idea of America, of a young man, is romantic. It's a myth. It's not the real America. I live in the real America, grapple with the real America. You know, the epigraph of my book is the Langston Hughes line, "Let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be." And I think all of us want to close the gap between the idea of America as it exists in our head and the reality of America that we now view.
Roger, you know, I read a passage from your book to my parents. You know, we came here as political refugees as well from the same country, close to your great-grandfather from the Soviet Union. And tears went down my mother's eyes, because it doesn't matter which generation you came in. Everyone has the same emotions, and knowing that they chose to come to this country and they worked to be Americans, and they lived the American dream, mopping floors, in your cases, working as a waiter in restaurants. Do you get a sense that that social mobility that so many people aspire for in this country still exists for those that want to come?
No, I can say that the day I became American was the day that I did decide to write this book. I held up over Twitter a photograph of myself with my new naturalization certificate, and it was a beautiful moment for me. To me, it was the greatest moment of my life to fulfill this dream, kid with a Statue of Liberty on his bedroom, to end up becoming an American, you know, a couple of hundred feet away from the statue itself. But in that moment, you know, over Twitter, there was a huge outburst of congratulations. I think my joy, the fact that I never take this for granted to be an American. It's something that I wake up every morning here in New York and I'm just genuinely honored by. But there was a real strain of individuals that said, felt the need to say, congratulations, you did it the legal way, the legal pathway, as opposed to and then tarnishing other people who aspire to the same dream. And the truth is, I didn't. You know, I was an illegal alien for a long time when I first arrived. And that's the beginning of my story. And that toxic reality, because I am white, funny, and on television, people project what they want and then project in the other way against many other people. I felt that, and it really pollinated a deeply and made toxic, to be candid, one of the happiest days of my life. So right then and there, I think I felt the challenge that your question hints at.
Well, and it's what you strive to achieve more of, and more unity in this country. I know for your children as well, and I could only imagine, without sounding too sappy, Roger, that your grandfather, who you spent so much time with and playing chess with and who you adored, who lived across the street from you, would be very proud that you finally made it to Chicago and now New York.
It's one of the joys of this book release. I mean, first of all, to be candid, it's deeply humbling to have my love letter to America reach the top of the bestseller list. It's deeply, deeply humbling how that has been received. But the second joy of it is to have my grandfather's memory live again and breathe again. His dad, my great-grandfather Harris, left Ukraine like millions at the turn of the 20th century. And he was a butcher and he wanted to go to Chicago, the hog capital of the world. And as you say, when the boat docked in Liverpool to refuel, he saw the one tall building on the Liverpool skyline, looked at it and thought, oh, we're here. We're in New York. Let's get off. And instead of going to the promised land, ended up in the northwest of England. And so that dream always, always just lived in our DNA. When things were dark in Liverpool, my grandfather would take this little cheap green tchotchke that's now on my desk of the Statue of Liberty. He'd take it off his shelf and we'd look at it and he'd say, we should have lived there. We should have lived there. So to fulfill that three-generation story, albeit 80, 85 years later than was originally intended, is genuinely the honor of my life. And I hope in 5-6 generations, my own family have my headshot over their dinner table and they point to it and they say, who's that bald dude? And they'll look at each other and be like, none of us can remember his name, but he's the one. He's the one that brought the family to America.
And there's a reason so many people can understand and relate to your story, because millions of people from around the world experience the very same thing. And you write it so beautifully, Roger. Congratulations for being an American. My parents and I celebrate our anniversary every year. And we thank you for joining us to talk about football and your journey to become an American. Thank you.
Bianca, thank you for having me, and big love to your parents.
We'll do. And joining me now for more discussion on what we can take away from Sunday's soccer match is CNN sports commentator Darren Lewis. Darren, thank you so much for coming on. You know, we wanted to talk today about the darling team in England, the second youngest team in the Euros there, the new face of England, a diverse face, young players. And here we see the wrath once again, the ugly side of social media and racism. And I want to get your take on what, you know, many people anticipated, including perhaps even football manager Gareth Southgate. He wrote a letter to England going into the Euros on June 8th and anticipated and discussed just this. How bad are things right now, and how will this impact the team?
Well, I heard you talking to Roger a second ago about your parents, and they came to the country and the way they forged a life for themselves. And I bet, just like my parents, they didn't think that 5 or so decades later, their children would still be fighting and doing what they can to highlight the issues that society continues to have with racism. But that remains the case, and as much as black and brown people, I would suggest, on both sides of the Atlantic, struggle to integrate themselves into society. Certainly in this country, the football has shown us that you are English when you are winning, but you are very much black and brown when the team aren't doing well. And what we've seen at the start of this tournament, we saw the players taking the knee, just as you guys have sportsmen doing over there, to highlight the issue of racist abuse. And at that point, what we saw was the Prime Minister and his Home Secretary refusing to condemn the people who were booing the players taking the knee. Then the players started to do well in the tournament, and they managed to get beyond the quarterfinal stage, which historically is when England normally bow out of tournaments. They reached the semi-final stage and a real momentum started to gather around the country. People started to seriously believe they could win the tournament. And suddenly the politicians, who wouldn't give those players the support they'd asked for, when they took the knee, when they tried to highlight racial injustice, suddenly the politicians were back on the bandwagon. And today we've had the Prime Minister now issuing more a finger wagging rather than a message of condemnation for the people who have been racially abusive. And it tells you everything about where we are as a country. We've been divided for the last 5 or 6 years since Brexit, even before the election. We have had so much divisive rhetoric from the leadership in this country. And what that has done, it's created a febrile atmosphere within which people have felt emboldened, empowered, able to kind of come out with the kind of thing that they wouldn't have done previously. Again, very similar to the other side of the Atlantic pre the election. And what we now have is people asking what the FA, the Football Association here in England, are going to do about the messages that the players are receiving. But the messages are just a symptom of something much bigger in this country that is much more structural, that we are going to have to fight, all of us together, to fight, to overcome, in order to ensure that the newer generation, the younger generation, don't have the same problems that we've had.
You know, two things came to mind when I read those vile messages this morning. And one was, you know, why wasn't the British goalie sort of receiving any backlash for allowing the Italians to score during the penalty kicks? I mean, this is not the direction that it should be going in, but it is striking that it was the three black players at the end who are on the receiving end of this ugly, vile racism. And my second thought was, if such prominent players in the world are subjected to this, what message does this send to the young brown and black boys and girls in the UK and around the world who, you know, aren't big names, aren't celebrities?
Well, as I say, it's all about inclusivity and acceptance. And what we've found historically, even away from sport, is that no matter how hard we try to integrate ourselves into society, we're only really useful if we can add something, win something, entertain, provide something. That's when black and brown people are useful. It's uncomfortable and it's not very nice to say, but I think a lot of our viewers watching right now will recognize what I'm saying, because this is all about acceptance. It actually has nothing to do with sport, and everything about the history that we have found of black and brown people not feeling inclusive, unless you're a good immigrant, unless you're someone who provides something. It's the kind of hostile environment that the government here in this country want to create. Unless you can bring something to the party, help us economically, then we'll consider you a good immigrant. And I think there are wider issues at play here than just the messages. As I said before, the messages are a symptom of something wrong. And you mentioned the goalkeeper. I kind of liken it to far more serious issues that are happening in terms of social justice in the US, where people say, look, we're not asking you to treat them in the same way you treat us. We're asking you not to insult them. Not to insult us, just like you don't insult them. And that is the point. Why is it that if you are black, if you are brown, suddenly you are cast aside if you put a foot wrong? It's a problem that we've had for the last 3 or 4 months, probably even longer, of the regular football season. It will happen again next season too.
And let the record show that no one should be insulted. I didn't mean that the goalkeeper should be insulted. I just noticed that wasn't the case here. And it sounds trite to say at this point, but, you know, we as a society and as humanity need to do better. And these athletes should be celebrated and not ridiculed and exposed to such vile treatment. Darren Lewis, thank you so much for joining us.
You.
The team got very far and they are darlings.
Thank you very much indeed. I agree.
And finally, in keeping with the theme of sport, which we were just discussing, on Sunday, Novak Djokovic secured a record-equaling 20th Grand Slam at Wimbledon. The Serbian ace bested Italy's Matteo Bertolini Bertagnini, over four sets, dashing Italian hopes of a whitewash at Wimbledon and the Euro. The Italians have a lot to celebrate still. But despite the racist abuse directed at England players after the soccer final, the two tournaments reminded us of the power of goodwill in sport. At Wimbledon, Djokovic gifted his match-winning racket to a young fan in a heartwarming moment reminiscent of another gem at the Euros. In case you missed it, England star Mason Mount made young Bell McNally's day when he gifted his shirt to the superfan at last week's semifinal. It's a wonderful moment, and we need more of those. Well, that is it for now. You can always catch us online on our podcast and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.